Well, I have to overcome my despondency tonight. Try and muster up some pep and zeal for preaching after the Steelers got trounced by the... They got trounced. We were lucky to score the points we did the way we were playing. It's funny. We saw it all season long. We would play, and the first half of the game, we'd come ahead. And then the third quarter, we would fall behind. And then the fourth quarter, we'd catch up and win all of a sudden. It's kind of like every game this season was, I don't know what you would say. So we really shouldn't have won, but we pulled it off at the last second with some kind of crazy cockamamie scheme. And so, we kind of looked at the season saying, I can't believe we're going into the playoffs. Well, now we're not. So it catches up with itself. We really weren't having that great of a season. So your sport's done here for another month or two, isn't it? NASCAR? Already. They have a long season then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's not snowing.
Really? Okay. So we have to wait till August now.
We'll see if you can follow NASCAR.
Pittsburgh doesn't have a NASCAR, though. Well, there must be someone from Pittsburgh. But, yeah. I know. Yeah, well. Yeah, we go sometimes and we'll sit at Rosati's in town when it's something we can't get on telecast here at the house. And so Kim and I will just go in and sit and have a drink. Not like a drink. Let me change this. Cherry Pepsi or something, yeah. Yeah, right. Yep. It's my day for putting my foot in my mouth, so at any rate. What was it? Oh yeah, so yeah, we just would go there and sit and drink a cherry Pepsi while we watch the game or something. And so you kind of get to talk to the wait staff and things, and they know us real well. So we walked out today, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry. And Kim says, well, I guess we'll see you next season. So, yeah. Oh, well, I guess we'll visit once in a while. But, you know. So, Rosati's is nice. I like their pizza. But every single time we order takeout from them, they get it wrong. I mean, anytime we have it delivered to the house, every time there's something missing. They do. They always bring it out. But I hate the, like, hey, can you please bring out the sauce for the salad? And, oh, we forgot that. Sorry. Yeah, okay. Can you please bring the breadsticks, too? Because you didn't bring those. Okay, we'll bring those out. So, all right. Well, it has been a few weeks, it feels like. What happened last? Last week I was sick, so we canceled, and it was icy. Did we have service the week before that? No, the week before that was New Year's. We didn't have service. The week before that was Christmas. We didn't have service. So it's been a while. That's why I feel a little out of sorts. Like, this feels a little odd. Okay. Yep. And you guys are saying, yeah.
That was hard to come to church.
You're getting out of the habit, huh?
Yeah.
Well, you didn't have to, but we're glad you're here. That's right, yeah. Well, do you have a remote start?
No, I don't.
No? Eldon? Yeah.
You'll have to find it before you can go home.
The car? You think it's going to get that much snow?
We'll wait and see.
Yeah, we will. Our remote starter is sitting back there. Yeah. Ethan, go start the car. We took him out today to get some driving practice, so after the dinner and the loss of the football game, I came home and I said, well, let's take Ethan out to get some driving practice. So he and I jumped in his car and drove to Princeton and then back on Route 6. So it turned in a little longer than I was expecting, but we took Route 34 out to Princeton and then stopped at McDonald's and got a coffee and then drove back Route 6. So it's been a long day. All right. We're in 1 Kings. We're actually quite a ways through 1 Kings, because if we're in chapter 18, there are only 22 chapters in 1 Kings. So we'll finish up 1 Kings here within the next month or so, and then we'll move on. 2 Kings, so kind of hard to predict how that'll go, because we do pick up speed as far as the timeline goes. We start passing through the kings of Israel pretty quickly. But the writer of 1 Kings has paused here to focus upon the ministry of Elijah, because we are at a turning point in the nation of Israel. God himself separated the nation into the north and the south. He did this on purpose because of the sins of Rehoboam. This is a disciplinary measure. It's not supposed to be permanent, because if you remember, the promise to David was that there would be a king over all Israel. And so this, as a disciplinary thing, is sort of like a timeout for the nation of Israel to get their attention. Which way are you going to go? Are you going to serve the Lord or aren't you? Well, so far, the record of the northern kings has not been good, especially Ahab's dynasty. His father, Omri, was bad, worse than anybody else that went before him. His son, Ahab, was worse than his dad, carrying on a proud family tradition of being idolatrous. And so along comes Elijah, who calls the nation to repentance by bringing them into a drought. He prays, and God stops the water flow in Israel, which, of course, is a very important thing to have when you're in a region like Israel. If the rain doesn't come at just the right times, you get some pretty bad results on your crops. So for 3.5 years, Elijah had prayed that it would not rain, and it hasn't rained. Well, he thinks the time is ripe now to catch the nation's attention and get them to make a very important decision. And so that's kind of where we come here in chapter 18. Elijah is trying to get the attention of Ahab. So he comes back into the nation. You know, he was sojourning himself up at Zarephath in the land of Sidon, Tyre and Sidon. And so he comes back into the nation of Israel, and he encounters Obadiah, the chief of Ahab's house. And that's what we looked at last time we were here in the beginning part of 18. Well, Obadiah is a little trepidatious. He doesn't quite want to tell Ahab where Elijah's at. Remember, he's afraid that the Spirit of God will snatch Elijah away again, and then he'll get in trouble for telling Ahab fibs. And so finally, though, Elijah does convince him, I'm actually here for this showdown, and I want you to tell your master where I'm at. Come and meet me. And so he does. And that's where we're picking up verse 17, 18, and 19, which we did last time, but we're going to review again. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, O troubler of Israel?" Anybody have a problem with that statement? Isn't that just like Satan? Go ahead, Eldon. Yeah, exactly, right. This is one of Satan's ploys, by the way. When things start going badly, will he ever look at himself and put the blame on his own actions? Never. Never. And you know what? People follow this rule all the time and say when things start going bad, who do they blame? Anybody else they can. Especially if things are going really bad, you'll find people blaming God that things are bad. Well, things are bad in Israel. Nobody's trying to say they aren't. No rain for 3.5 years is bad. And the very fact that Ahab and Obadiah were on this march trying to search throughout the country to find any shred of grassland left for the royal cattle to feed upon tells you how bad things were getting. And so when Ahab sees Elijah and says this, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" He's pointedly refusing to acknowledge where the fault lies. So when a parent has to discipline a kid, whose fault is it that the kid is experiencing discipline? Children, whose fault is it? Mom and dad's, right? Obviously, mom and dad, why are you punishing me? This hurts. I don't enjoy this. It's no fun. Well, of course it's not. Now, it would be something else if a parent were making up arbitrary rules and then punishing their children without telling them. So I just grab Timmy and I start slapping him across the face and I say, you should not have worn a blue shirt today. I can't believe you did that. Smack, 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 right? He'd have every right to be aggravated and frustrated, wouldn't he? Because have I ever given you a rule not to wear blue shirts? No, I haven't. So the distinction here, though, is that when a parent is consistent, and this is true of God as well, when a parent is consistent and there is a rule that is consistently applied and taught, but then violated, the parent is absolutely just to administer discipline. God did the same thing. When you go back in Deuteronomy, I want you to turn to chapter 28. Deuteronomy 28. We're going to look at the nation of Israel has come close to the land, and they are they're supposed to recite these blessings and cursings to each other so that they will know God is being consistent. He's not making up arbitrary rules. He told them ahead of time what the rules are. The whole book of Deuteronomy are the rules, tells you what the rules are. In chapter 28, God is telling the nation ahead of time the blessings and the cursings for obedience or disobedience. So Israel has no excuse to look at God in 1 Kings 17 or 18 and have any complaint that he didn't tell them ahead of time. God is not making stuff up as he goes along. And so we're going to go to chapter 28, verse 15. Deuteronomy 28:15. Here's the curses. If you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Here's the curses. See, here's God outlining the punishments beforehand. And we tell this to our kids when they were little. If you do this, this will be the consequence. Right? And then when they do it, they shouldn't be surprised at the consequence, right? Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the field. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your ground, the increase of your herds and the young of your flock. Cursed shall you be when you come in. Cursed shall you be when you go out. So that sounds like a pretty dire space to be in, right? When God has placed this kind of curse on you. Your fields won't produce. Your own bodies won't produce. You're not going to have children productively. Your herds won't produce. When you go out to fight, it's not going to work. When you come back in to retreat, you're not going to be able to escape. All of these things. Verse 20, the Lord will send on you curses, confusion, and frustration in all that you undertake to do until you are destroyed and perish quickly on account of the evil of your deeds because you have forsaken me. So what's the wrong that they've committed? What did they do wrong in here in Deuteronomy 28? What's he say they've done wrong? You didn't keep my commandments. You forsook me. Okay. You stepped away from the statutes that I gave you. You stepped out of the boundaries that I set for you. And therefore, you're going to experience these curses. Verse 21, the Lord will make the pestilence stick to you until he has consumed you off the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Disease will strike you. Verse 22, the Lord will strike you with wasting disease and fever, inflammation and fiery heat, and with drought and with blight and with mildew. They shall pursue you until you perish. Did you notice that one in there? Drought. What's Israel experiencing in 1 Kings 18? Drought. Okay. This was supposed to be a signal to them that they're doing the wrong thing. The heavens over your head shall be bronze. The earth under you shall be iron. Gary, what kind of implement you got to use to plow iron? Plasma cutters. Yeah. I don't think those were in great supply in the 18th century BC, were they? No. I mean, we have to use iron to break the ground, right? Because the ground gets hard. So what happens when the ground is iron? What do you use to break it apart? I don't know. What kind of plants would grow out of the iron that's produced by a plasma cutter? Dandelions. They'll grow anywhere, won't they? Dandelions. Yeah, right. I wonder if the dandelion would grow like with an orange tint if it's growing out of iron. Yeah. Would they still be so easy to kick off with your foot, or would you better not try that? Have to have steel-toed boots to do that, right? The heavens over your head shall be bronze, the earth under you shall be iron. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder, and from heaven dust shall come down on you until you are destroyed. It continues on the rest of the chapter with all the different curses that God will put upon the nation of Israel. But that right there should be enough to tell them we're on the wrong track. If we see a 3-year drought in our land, what's the problem? Us. We haven't been doing what God wanted us to do. We haven't been following His commandments. We've abandoned Him. And so you can turn back to 1 Kings 18 then. So when Ahab says, "Oh, you troubler of Israel," he's really blinded to what's going on here. What did Ahab do to Israel? Idolatry, yeah. Probably the other one too. You know, sins very rarely go one at a time. They always go two by twos. And Ahab led the nation into blatant idolatry. He was the first king to bring in the pagan temples. Now the people had mingled the worship of Jehovah with the worship of other gods before this. But Ahab was the one that, made it official with the support from his government. And not only that, his wife has apparently 400 prophets of Asherah on the public payroll. So they are publicly supporting the worship of other gods while the worship of Jehovah is being squelched, right? And so who's the troubler of Israel here? And Elijah knows this, and so he counters in verse 18. He answered, "I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals." Say, look, Ahab, if you're looking for the one that's causing problems in the country, just look in the mirror. This is you. You've done this to the country, not me. You've abandoned God. You're following the Baals. Verse 19, here's the challenge. "Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So that phrase, "eating at Jezebel's table," is where we tell that they're being publicly supported. Because where does the queen get her money? What's that? Tax dollars, right. The queen gets her money from the king. The king gets his money from tax dollars. Governments don't just make money appear out of thin air, do they? Well, maybe they do. No. The Federal Reserve does that. Just print off another round of it. We're a little shy today. All right. There you go. Yeah, bitcoins. Yep. Mm-hmm. Oh, don't get me on bitcoins. You know, I will forever be a poor man because I never go into those things. And I should have bought them when they were a dollar. And now they're worth what? They're like something like $12,000 right now for a Bitcoin. So, that's what I think. It doesn't exist. It's nothing. What? Somebody paid $12,000 for a computer equation. Well, I can't say too much, I guess. Oh boy. But you know, I guess when you, well, let me see here. I mean, really, what's the intrinsic value of that thing anyway? I mean, is it any different? We say that's worth a dollar. There's nothing a dollar about that. It's a piece of paper with ink on it. Maybe we should all buy gold. Eldon. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's back when we had we had to have precious metals to back up the value of the dollar. What backs up the value of the dollar now? Trust in the government. Oh boy, that dollar just went down. I'm getting off topic. I know. I was going to say something else about bitcoins, and then I forgot. Oh, well, that's okay. Did he? Yeah. Yeah, there's articles all over the web right now about how Bitcoin's going to drop out and some other cryptocurrency is going to come into place. But, you know, the wealth of the world is, it's fluid. It's not really there. It's all fake. Do you know Mark Zuckerberg lost $4 billion in value on Friday? That's a shame. Yeah. I lost a quarter once. It drove me nuts. You know, $4 billion. Because the stock market dropped. So, you know, when they come up with these lists of richest people, what, Jeff Bezos finally made top. He is now the most valuable man in the world at about $106 billion.
But he lost that value because he wanted families to communicate face-to-face.
Yes, right.
That sounds like a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's coming from Facebook, it's not a good thing. So just, yeah, I'm going to get myself in trouble because this is being recorded, but, you know. I can guarantee you if it's from Facebook, it's probably not about getting families actually closer together. It's like stare at each other through the screen while you're sitting across from the table. That's I'm going to move on now because, all right. So verse 20, here's the challenge in verse 19. I want you to gather all Israel and 950 prophets of these idolatrous temples that are being supported at public expense. And he's got a challenge for them. So there's the summons. Gather everybody together. So Ahab listens to this. Verse 20. Ahab sent to all the people of Israel. He gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. This becomes a major defining event in the history of Israel. And it's an interesting one. Now the Mount Carmel he's talking about, if you look up on a map, there will be a Mount Carmel right here at the peak of this little promontory on the Mediterranean Sea. That's probably not where we're talking about. There's a very old cathedral built here in honor of Elijah, but it's probably not where this contest took place because some of the descriptions of what happened with people looking up at what's going on. I mean, all Israel's gathered here. It's not just the 950 prophets and priestesses, right? All of Israel's gathered. So we need a place where we can fit all of the people. So this entire mountain range that starts at this peak and runs down this way in a south easterly direction towards the Jordan River Valley, this is called the Mountains of Carmel. And along here, somewhere around here, there is a peak that would work very well for a very public display because there's a sheer cliff. And at the bottom, there's a nice flat spot that would accommodate lots of people. So the entire nation could be looking up at this mountain and seeing what's going on. Elijah wants this to be public. He wants this to be seen by everybody that is there. And so we don't know exactly where it's at. Probably not up here at this promontory point that's usually labeled Mount Carmel. My guess would be somewhere closer between Megiddo and Taanach, maybe a little bit farther down. Because very quickly after this, they run to Jezreel. And so Jezreel is not that far from this place. Excuse me. But Ahab gathers everybody. So we're probably talking a couple of days' time to get the nation of Israel together here and summon everyone. So verse 21, here is the challenge. He summoned everybody. Now Elijah's going to give the challenge. Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions?" And here's this picture that he's presenting of. We use this term. You're trying to walk the fence. So you know what that term is, right? Like you're on top of the split rail. I don't want to be in his side. I don't want to be completely on that side. I want to be right in the middle. Kim and I were dating, walking at ABC, and we used to just walk this path around campus after supper and talk to each other and, you know, gaze into each other's eyes and all that fun stuff. So I was trying to show off or something, but I stood up on the handrail and started walking along the handrail. And of course she says, "You're going to fall." And you know what happened, right? I said, "No, I'm not." And down I fell. And all of my show-offiness spilled on the ground, right? So Here's this picture that Elijah is using. You're limping between two. You can't settle on one leg or the other because you're trying to be both things. You're trying to worship Baal and you're trying to worship Jehovah. Is our world any different today? This is the big push in society. Our society desperately wants everything to be true at one time. Talked about this in Sunday school this morning, how comfortable the world is with contradiction. So, the world wants us all to be just okay with, well, whatever's good for Eldon is good for Eldon, but that doesn't mean it's good for Kim or that it's good for me. So, you know, Eldon, you want to go to church and worship Christ, that's fine, but if Kim wants to go to a different place and worship something else, she should be allowed to, that's okay. And Gary can pick something altogether different. And the world loves that kind of contradiction. And when we come along and say, look folks, the scriptures tell us that it's either the true God or something else, that's why we get looked at skewed. They say, what do you mean it's either or? You don't have to pick either or, it can be anything. And we say, no, this language of the scripture does not allow for inclusivism. It doesn't allow for syncretism. It doesn't allow for pluralism. It is either Jehovah God and His Son Jesus Christ, or something else. But it cannot be both. I shouldn't even say the Scripture says it's either or. The Scripture says it's one way, right? I mean, we use this verse all the time, John 14:6. I am the way, the truth, the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. That's a very exclusive statement. Well, what Elijah is saying here is that things are very exclusive as well. What does the law tell Israel? Behold, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. So how much of your heart can go to Baal? So if I give 10% to Baal and 90% to God, is that okay? I mean, God did say, you shall have no other gods before me, right? So that means as long as no gods are more important to me than God, then I'm okay. So as long as He's still at the top, I can have several below Him? Is that what that means? What does that mean? You shall have no other gods before me. None at all. I love the way the Westminster Catechism explains this. It says, when it uses the word before me, what it means is in my presence. You will have no other gods in my presence. So not as a matter of priority, but a matter of proximity. It's not that you can't have a God that's more important to me, but it's okay to have a God less important to me. It's that you will have no gods in my sight anywhere. You're dwelling in my land. Anybody ever actually have to say this to your kids? While you're in my house, you obey my rules, right? God says, while you're in my land, you'll do as I say. There will be no other gods in my land. Israel's violated that. And it's not just a casual violation of it anymore. It is official. It's sanctioned. It is the king of Israel, Ahab, and his wife Jezebel now officially sanctioning, promoting, supporting, supplying idolatry. And so that's why Elijah is going to come along and say, you've got to make a decision. Pick one way or the other. You can't continue to claim to be God's people and be worshiping Baal at the same time. That doesn't work. Syncretism. Something I think that the church has got to work on as well. We should be. We understand we all bring baggage into the Christian life, right? None of us gets saved and is immediately perfect. We understand that. We're not looking for perfection. And we understand that some people are farther along on that spiritual journey than others are. But the goal is, are we progressing? Am I slowly banishing from my life the things that are drawing my attention away from the Lord Jesus? Or am I allowing them with all the contradiction that comes with that? And saying, yeah, I want to serve God, but no, I don't want to get rid of that idol. I don't want to get rid of that thing that's keeping me from serving Him. We can't do that. Because then we're violating the command that says you'll love the Lord your God with all your heart, not 90% of it. Sometimes we treat God and our worship of Him like we treat our tithes and offerings, right? God asks for 10%. Does that mean God doesn't want the rest of your money? Well, no, he gives that to you to use it, doesn't he? But it's still his. He wants you to use it to provide your needs, but does he not want that 90% to go the way that he wants it to go? So we give God 10% of our offerings, but the rest of it we're free to do with whatever we want? No, he owns it all. We should acknowledge him with every penny of it. Well, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. Make a decision, people. And the people did not answer him a word. Love that. They're just standing there like, we don't know which way to go. Because obviously, I mean, it sounds really bad to say we think Jehovah's not actually God, so we don't want to follow him, right? We don't want to make that call. Who wants to say that? But you know what? We kind of like this Baal worship thing. It's fun. It's trendy. It's popular. Everybody loves it. We don't want to get rid of it. So Elijah's calling them to make this decision. You got to pick one or the other. Verse 22, then Elijah said to the people, I, even I only, am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now Elijah is indulging in a little bit of self-pity here. And he's going to find out otherwise later on in the chapter, okay? Actually in chapter 19. He's going to find out that's not exactly true. But at the same time, how many people are standing with Elijah here? None here. Nobody's standing up with him here. You ever had to stand against 450 people? You ever had to stand against 100 people? You ever had to stand against one other person? Most of us like to be liked. I mean, it's just kind of who we are as people. I don't like to not be liked. It's no fun. But to stand on a principle, even against one other person, is a hard thing to do. When you know that it's not popular. When you know there's 400, at least, other people completely against you, it's even harder. So we can't take away from the bravery of what Elijah's doing here, the boldness that this was requiring. But he is indulging in a little bit of self-pity. I'm the only one left. Nobody understands me, right? Well, he's setting that up. One of the reasons he mentions that is because he's going to set up the challenge here. There's 450 of you. There's one of me. So the odds are in whose favor? I mean, if you had to go with something, would you go with small numbers or big numbers? If you had to pick between $1 and $450, which one are you going to pick? Yeah, you want to pick the bigger number, right? Okay, so odds are in their favor. Verse 23, let two bowls be given to us, and let them choose one bowl for themselves, and cut it in pieces, and lay it on the wood, and put no fire to it. Who gets to pick the first of the bowls? The Baal worshippers. So do you think they're going to pick the better one or the worse one? Probably the better one. Would Baal be pleased with a good bowl or the lesser bowl? Doesn't going to make any difference, is it? And Elijah knows that, right? But in the Baal worshippers' theology, is Baal going to want a good bowl or a lesser bowl? He's going to want a good bowl. So Elijah is stacking the deck in the favor of the Baal worshippers. There's more of you. So if his ear is turned by noise, well, you guys can make a lot more noise than one person can, so he's going to hear you. If God is intrigued by the offerings of people, then hey, there's more of you. You're going to be able to catch his attention better. If your God his attention is attracted by the quality of the sacrifice, fine, you take the best one. I'll take the other one. I'll take second dibs. Yeah. Let the two bowls be given to us. You're going to choose one bowl. You're going to cut it in pieces. In other words, prepare it for the sacrifice. And you're going to lay it on your altar. But here's the clincher. You don't put the fire on the altar. And this is where everybody would be saying, what? So how are we going to offer this thing up to our God? Remember, in the theology of the nations around Israel at the time, what does the God do with that sacrifice? He's eating it. Now wait a second, how's he eating it? He's consuming it like the fire does, right? So as the fire burns, the fire is destroying the physical part of the sacrifice, and the God is consuming the life force of the sacrifice. That's kind of the conception. Now, what's the biblical conception? The smell. It always talks about this sweet smelling aroma. Okay? Do you know smell is your sense most strongly linked to memory? That's why sometimes you'll smell something and say, oh, that reminds me of whatever. Gary, it just cracked me up that day I butchered my roosters. And you walked in here and said, wow, that smells like when I was a kid, butchering roosters. I said, takes you right back, doesn't it? Like, you smell that, and you're right there. You know, sometimes you'll get a whiff of something and say, oh, that's grandma's apple pie. Wow, I'm right back in grandma's kitchen. Okay. Your smell is connected to your memory. And I love that imagery, especially in the Old Testament. It talks about the sacrifice as a sweet-smelling aroma. What do you think that sacrifice is reminding God of? He's not eating it, obviously. He doesn't need it. Worship. Yeah. And I think ultimately, it's a reminder to us, and not that he needs reminders, but a reminder to us of his son and that sacrifice, that offering that Christ made. You say, well, this is before that. Well, yeah, but you know, do you think God sees time the way we see it? I think God sees time as like all at once. We see it as happening, progressing. I don't think he sees it that way. Anyway. Lay it on there. Don't put any fire on it. Here is the challenge. Verse 24. You call upon the name of your God. I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. Here's the test. What is Baal the God of in Canaanite theology? The storm. What comes with storms? Lightning. So we're talking about fire from heaven here. We're talking about lightning. Strike the sacrifice, catch it on fire, burn it up. Right? If Baal's the god of the storm, well, first of all, for 3.5 years he hasn't been able to do anything. He's been rendered completely powerless by Jehovah. But, you know, we'll give him this one last duel between Jehovah and Baal. Whichever God can consume a sacrifice by lightning that normally comes with storms, he will be God. Now, here's the other thing. How long has it been since it rained? 3.5 years. How many clouds do you think are in the sky? How much lightning usually comes with no clouds? Not very many, right? Now, does Elijah have precedent on which to base this scenario? Any other time God called down fire from heaven? Before Elijah, by the way.
When they were coming into Israel, did he bring down fire on the Egyptians?
Well, there's the pillar of fire that came down. Yeah, that would definitely be some of the imagery going on here. But when they sanctified the tabernacle around Sinai, who started the first sacrificial fire? God did. He didn't let a single person lay a hand on that fire. They put the offering on there and God himself started the fire. And they were supposed to have kept that fire burning. It was never supposed to go out. You remember when Elihu, Aaron's son, Nadab and Abihu, that's it. Says they died before the Lord because they offered strange fire. It's because it was a fire that they started themselves. They were offering their own version of worship, and God said, no, don't do that. I'm giving you the proper mode of worship, and I'm going to let you know which one's the proper mode of worship by, poof, I'm setting that sacrifice on fire on that altar. You do this my way. Don't try to do this your own way. Elijah's challenge is similar. You can't approach me and call me Baal. It's not the same thing. Doesn't it drive you nuts? When someone says, oh, you know, Christians in this religion, they worship the same God. Pick your religion. I'm not trying to pick on one, but you hear it a lot about certain ones, right? No, we don't. Study what their God is like and study our God. They're different. And Elijah's putting this before the people. You can't keep holding on to Baal and the worship of Jehovah and think that everything's good. You're not right with one of them. Which one do you want to be right with? Well, let's prove which one is the real God, the one that can answer by fire. You call upon the name of your God, I'll call upon the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he's God. And all the people said, not a chance, Elijah. That's the craziest cockamamie scheme we have ever heard of. No, they said, sounds like a good idea to me. Let's do it. This should be fun, right? Let's put them to the test. Verse 25, then Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, okay, choose for yourselves one bowl, prepare it first, for you are many, and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it. I love how he adds that thing at the last. He reiterates all the rules, but he adds on there at the end, put no fire to it. It's almost like, I've got my eye on you. Don't you try to cheat. Because I know what you Baal worshippers are like. And actually, we have some ancient literature that says they would try this once in a while. They would build an altar and they would have somebody like hide in a little tunnel underneath and set fire to it so that nobody could see it and try to trick people with false miracles. So he's warning them, I'm watching you. Don't you try it. Don't put any fire to it. So verse 26, they took the bowl that was given them. They prepared it. And they called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon. How long is that?
A long time when somebody's not answering.
Yeah, it's a long time when nobody's answering. Yeah. Hours, hours, hours. At least three, probably more than that. My guess is that the local Israelites were probably up pretty close to the sun. And so, you know, if it's summertime, you might be talking about 6 hours. If it's wintertime, you still might be talking about 4 or 5 hours. So this is a long time. Morning until noon, they're saying, oh, Baal, answer us. Now, I have had times in my life where I cried out to God for what seemed like forever. And he said nothing. Nope, nope, nope. I think I've told you when I was in seminary, I'm commuting 2.5 hours to work one way every day. 2.5 hours to get there, 2.5 hours to get back. And we were looking for housing close to seminary, and I just kept praying, Lord, we need a house. Please open up something. And it seemed like every day I would open my Bible for devotions, I was reading something in the Psalms that would say, wait on the Lord, wait, I say, on the Lord. I'm like, I can't wait any longer. Right. You know, it was 3 days before classes started that we finally found a place to stay close to seminary. We spent that whole summer in that situation commuting, saying, Lord, we need something. I mean, I only got 2 months left. I need to get in, get settled in, get the house set up. And he said, not yet, you don't. It's, Lord, it's only a month away. I need to get in here. I really need a place to stay. Not yet, you don't. Just wait. Well, they go on from morning till noon. I mean, when this is the definitive proof to the nation of who is the true God, you would think that Baal would answer by this time, right? Well, he's not. The end of the verse there, was no voice, no one answered. He's very emphatic about this point. No one, nothing, not even a semblance of an answer comes from Baal on this. Now, is Baal real? I think he is. He's not God. But I have no doubt that Satan has his little minions running around the world impersonating gods. Do they do miracles? Sometimes. Who destroyed Job's house with a whirlwind? Satan did. Who struck Job's children down? Satan did. Who made Job sick? Satan did. Okay, Satan's got a lot of power. And I think a lot of times he does perform miracles. That's why a miracle itself is not the definitive proof that something is true. But I think in this case, God commanded Baal, whatever demon he is, say, you're going to be quiet. Don't you say a word. And he just has to stand there while all his people jump and hoop and holler and yell. He says nothing. No voice. No one answered. They limped around that altar that they had made. And at noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, oh, I want to get to this part. This is, okay, we'll get through this verse. We'll introduce it and we'll cover the rest of it later, okay? At noon, so after they've been doing this for several hours, they're all tired and exhausted, he says, cry aloud, for he is a god. Now, does Elijah mean that? No, he doesn't mean that, okay? He's being sarcastic. You have to love God's sense of humor, all right? God has a sense of humor, by the way. He's being sarcastic. He's a god. Either he's musing or he is... Now, some of you... Yeah, Dan's reading this, right? And you're laughing, okay? Gary, I think you have King James, right? Can you read that verse for us? What is the God probably doing? Verse 27.
The whole verse,
yeah, give me the whole verse.
And it came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked him and said, cry aloud, for he is a God. Either he is talking, or he is pursuing, or he is in a journey, or peradventure he sleepeth, and must be awake.
Yeah. All right. Cry aloud. He's a god. He's either busy, musing, the ESV says. The next one, the King James says he's pursuing, right?
Pursuing.
Yeah. Okay, here's where you get funny. Dan, what does your ESV say?
Relieving
himself, okay? That's gentle. That's gentle. This is a Hebrew euphemism. The King James translators knew this, but they really didn't want to put it in print. Okay? And I think the literal wording is covering their feet. Is the Hebrew euphemism. Because, and it's the picture of when you have to use the facilities and you're wearing a robe, what do you do with it? Yeah, you would, you know, drop it around your ankles so that you could relieve yourself. And so the King James translators kind of ran across this and said, we can't have people reading this in church every Sunday. You know, that's a little too crass. And so they kind of put a little different spin on it. He's pursuing. The ESV translators make it, he's relieving himself, which is sort of a gentle euphemism too, right? We say going to the bathroom. Well, we all know what happens in a bathroom, right? So we don't actually describe what's going on there. Although, I was sitting at table at ABC one time, and there was this fellow who didn't seem to have a whole lot of, I don't want to say political correct. His manners were not quite what everybody else's were. And he finished eating, and he promptly declared that he had to go use the facilities, but he didn't use the euphemisms, right? He actually said what he had to go do. And he stood up and walked out. We all just sit there looking at each other like, that was interesting. So there's the euphemism. Elijah is using this sarcasm to say, look, your God, he's talking to somebody, he's busy, or maybe he's using the facilities. Or maybe he's on a journey, or he's sleeping. Now, we laugh at this imagery of a God doing these things, but that's what they thought. Okay? How many of you ever, when you're in school, you studied Greek mythology, right? Was that still part of the normal school routine? We did a little bit. But you get these stories of the Greek gods, and you find out they are basically people with power. Okay? So, Vulcan, not the Star Trek Vulcan, by the way, with the ears, right? Vulcan, the god of fire, can control the Earth's fire. He can make volcanoes erupt. He can cause things to... Okay, he's basically a god. He gets hungry. He goes to sleep. Okay? The gods of the ancient nations engaged in just about every activity that we as normal people do. And they were bad about it, actually. They were worse sinners than most people were. Yeah, because if you had absolute power like that, wouldn't you use it in a bad way? Well, they did. And so they really genuinely thought that if my God has to eat, well, I have to eat, so my God must have to eat. And well, when I eat, I have to use the restroom, so my God must have to do that too. And this is how they conceived of their God. And in fact, the worship of the gods was meant to provide their needs. So we construct a temple, and that's a place where my God can come down from all of his heavenly activities and rest. And I can feed him the sacrifice. And he can take a break. And he can relax while I minister to him. That's what worship was. Okay? And so these pictures, we look at it and say, wow, Elijah's really being kind of, you know, sarcastic here. He wasn't. He was saying exactly what the Baal worshippers would have thought maybe their God was doing. And so we look at it and say, you worship what? And they say, huh, maybe you're right. Maybe he is. Maybe he's just asleep. Let's scream louder. Because verse 28, they cried aloud. And they cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And we say, what? But if you want to attract your God's attention, don't you want to show him how serious you are about this? Well, look here, Baal, we're pretty serious. We need you to say something, so here's how serious I am. I'm not going to offer just this bull's blood. I'm really serious. I'm going to give you some of mine. Why did some of the Aztec nations and even the Moabites, why was human sacrifice so important to them? Because that was really serious. If I want to show my God how serious I am and how much I need his help, I give him something very, very valuable. Human life. And of course, we know from scriptures that God says never, no way. He doesn't want human life. So, we'll have to pack things up there. I kept you a few minutes late. Any questions or comments?